No Q&A anymore. Hi, everybody. This is Joanne from Read Science, and I am joined here with my co-host, Jeff Schomeyer, as always. And today we are so honored to have with us our guest, Barbara Oakley. Say hi, Barbara, really quick.
Well, hello, hello.
Yeah, so Barbara, I've gotten to know Barbara over the past 7 or 8 years because the first time I decided to darken YouTube's footsteps was with a book review about her. Well, it's not your first book. I forgot about your first book, but the first book I found out about was called Evil Genes. And the subtitle, I think, was what got me to buy it: Why Rome Fell, Hitler Rose, and Ron Failed, and My Sister Stole My Mother's Boyfriend.
Oh.
Okay. And I went, okay, I should check this out. And anyway. So that was the first book I read, first book I reviewed of yours that I read, and first book I reviewed. But since then, you have been very busy, and we are so fortunate to have you tell us all about your books. But I do want to mention, first of all, her latest book, and I'm sorry, you guys, I have the galley, so I've got the black binding, Mind Shift, Breakthrough Obstacles to Learning and Discover Your Hidden Potential. And so I think, you know, this probably falls under self-help, but it's also science. You've got neuroscience, which you started to delve into, and we're looking forward to your story. But she's also got this book, which has done very well, A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. But this book was turned into a Coursera MOOC, which is one of the largest Coursera MOOCs, isn't it?
It is. It's actually, as far as we know, it is the largest MOOC around. We've had nearly 2 million registered learners, but there's also a MOOC for Mindshift. So
That's a new one.
Complement one another. Yeah. But I think people often don't know that my work in teaching and learning that relates to neuroscience all grew out of the research I did initially when I was working on the book Evil Genes.
So if you read anything of Barbara's, you will learn a little bit about Barbara, and including that you were in the Army, that you were a Russian translator, you met your husband at the South Pole Station, that you're an engineer, and now you delved into neuroscience and education. So
right.
This is, you know, rather than a formal biography here, reading a bio of yours, I'll just summarize, because I'm hoping you'll talk about this because this is sort of the essence of Mind Shift. Mm-hmm. We can change our mind and we can change our lives and we can find out that we can do all sorts of things. And you're sort of like the embodiment of the book. You know, what I know about you, I'm like, well, okay. This is, you're like the living example, even though you use lots of other real life examples.
I think part of it is looking back and really thinking about, you know, why have I made so many changes and how has that evolved to be, you know, something that generally people really like. I think it has to do with just being really learning to be comfortable with feeling like an imposter, mm-hmm. who wasn't really as good as everyone else, who's just playing catch up. And I've done that so many times that now I'm kind of used to it. So even when I was working on the book Evil Genes, so what Evil Genes was about was my oldest sister was, shall we say, a problematic person.
She stole your mother's boyfriend.
She did.
That's problematic.
Yeah. And my parents still always loved her, even though she was really a very troubled person. And part of what happened was when she was 3 years old, she got polio. And it, I would say, basically, really set her life completely off course. And the more I researched it, the more I found out that, you know, polio in some small portion, it affects everyone's brains, you know, if you get polio. It always has some damages some motor neurons and other areas of the brain. Many people recover from this and are highly successful in their lives. And in part, I think it's, you know, the challenge of overcoming polio can sort of set you on a course of where you're trying to improve yourself. So it helps change your own attitude and helps you to be successful. But in a small number of people, it can, the brain damage can be really quite severe. And my sense is that it damaged her attentional abilities. So she would do things like she ran away from home when she was about 19, and she was gone for 10 years. And my parents, of course, were really beside themselves. But at the same time, she was an adult. You couldn't look for people the way you can now. It was much harder to just disappear. And so she was gone 10 years. And then suddenly she contacted my father and said, "I'm so sorry for what I've done." You know, she had a very tumultuous childhood, and I just love to come home and say I'm sorry and start afresh. And of course, my father was absolutely thrilled at this. So he sent her the money so she could fly home, and she spent it on something else. And so he sent her more money, and she didn't get tickets. She spent it on something else. So he finally got smart and sent her the actual tickets that she needed, the plane tickets. So she came, and I remember her coming up and hugging me, and she was like, "Barb, I'm so glad to be home, to see you, to see the family, and I'm just so thrilled to learn what you're doing and spend these next weeks just sort of becoming reacquainted." And then she excused herself to go down to the store. She met a man who she'd never met before, moved in with him, and I didn't see her for another 5 years. And so you might think, well, that's pretty crazy. But actually, she, as I came to discover, her attentional mechanisms were really challenged. There was damage there due to the polio, and she was one of those ones where the damage was clearly, it's a good guess, it was quite substantive. And so I wasn't standing in front of her at that store. I was still back at the house. But that guy at the store was right in front of her. He had her attention. So she forgot about everything else and moves in with this guy. And so wondering about things like this, about the kinds of things she could do to my parents just obliviously, without even thinking about it. And I began to wonder, now, wait a minute. I'm a professor of engineering. I should, even if I don't know neuroscience, I should be able to at least look at the research literature and see what it says about mean people who do, you know, who do stuff like this. Not psychopaths per se, but just kind of mean people. And so I started looking, and, you know, I found this, term in psychology, sort of Machiavellian kind of personalities. And I was like, great, here's the term. You know, I'll go Google it up. I'll look at what science says. And then I found out that all these psychological papers had no scientific foundation whatsoever. It was just a bunch of people kind of, farting around, coming up with stuff. And I mean, I shouldn't be so facetious, but actually I should be, because there was no there. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote about the fact that psychology had a lot of spurious notions and ill-founded publications that really had no scientific backing whatsoever. And that was part of the whole book, was sort of trying to tease out why do people do mean things? What do we know from research? What is actually substantive from research? And it was far less at that time than I ever dreamed. And so the reaction to the book was kind of funny, because I sat there for I'm going on here, but this is like,
that's okay.
Nobody ever, you know, it's been a while back. And so people don't usually realize the connection between, you know, what my work in involving neuroscience is and how it all grew out mm-hmm. of working on this book. But I sat there, I was trying to get tenure. My father had Alzheimer's. I had a, you know, my family with, you know, our two small children, and I'm also trying to work on this book in the background. And thank goodness my husband is, Philip is just a, he's a wonderful human being. That's the smartest thing I ever did was say yes to that man when he proposed. But I, for 6 years, I worked in the background of working on this book, Evil Genes, about what we really know about, you know, sort of why do people do nasty things who are not necessarily, you know, evil people, and trying to tease out the difference between biology and upbringing and, you know, environmental influences. And I remember at the time going, why on earth am I doing this? Nobody is ever going to read an engineer's take on psychology. But at the same time, it was like, wait a minute. This is a big story that there's no there in psychological research in this area. And so fortunately, when, you know, the book was published after 40 publishers rejected it, and then it got superlative reviews from the likes of Steven Pinker and, you know, some really top people. So it was like a lot of work. But what that really was doing, I didn't realize it at the time, was setting the stage for work in other areas.
I think Mindshift may have spoken particularly to me because I've been a restless career person, and I'm a pretty long distance, at least it would appear to most people, it doesn't seem that far to me, from the, you know, physics lab I was doing research in 30 years ago. I still feel like I'm solving problems and finding interesting things, but I'm not doing the physics research. And one thing that seemed like a main theme for me, and you said, I'll quote from something near the end of the book, where you said, mind shift, deep changes in life that occur through learning is something that can be done at any age with any goal in mind. So I'd like to kick you off and say, well, let's talk about for a while the importance of continuing to learn and how can people return to learning who've lost the habit?
That is such a great question. I'd like to hear, how do you keep with continued learning?
It for me, I think, as if I can find a new thing to move into, I usually feel at my freshest when I'm learning how to solve the problems at hand. And so I went from the physics lab at low temperatures, then I went and I did a space shuttle experiment. Well, we had lots of aerospace to learn about, microgravity science. I had moved into, this was an optics experiment, and I'd never done optics before, but I brought along expertise at temperature control. And then later on, I went to an aerospace company, so I had some aerospace experience and milieu, and I already had done a lot of computer work because our experiment on the space shuttle was automated, and I was in charge of most of that, because it interested me for years. And so I did a lot of computer things. I worked with a group that was building a new computer for the Hubble Space Telescope. And then I also worked with a friend who was interested in doing satellite communications for, of all things, deep sea ocean buoys. So he'd gotten some money from the government to collaborate with Woods Hole. That spun off into a corporation that we started to do basically cheap satellite communications. And this is now almost 20 years ago when it was not a thing that everyone could do easily and buy off the shelf. And then I was ungainfully underemployed for a number of years. And someplace in there, Joanne and I started doing this, which is at least fulfilling, if not remunerative. And then a friend, a neighbor actually, who works here at Gallaudet in the Office for Students with Disabilities, said, I think we need a new handbook. This is while I was still at home. Do you think you could write one of those? I said, sure, I could write one of those because I've also been writing fiction now for the past 10 years. I think I can write it. So I did. She says, oh, couldn't you come in for a few days a week? And so I'm now working full time here, doing all of the communications things. And that's communication stuff and science stuff. And here I am with Joanne doing science communications. And the learning just seemed to be a natural thing because I get restless at doing the same thing over again. And so I have to change, and change means learning new things, and learning new things when it's to solve something at hand is the best way to, is the most productive way for me to learn. And it's exciting, but you do have to get with that thing, that fear of, that you mentioned someplace else, of the pain of learning new things because it's work, and that feeling of being the stupidest one in the place, but trying to get some work done. That was answering your question or something. You're going to tell me now about how to make lifelong learning a habit. And one other question that folds in from the book was, we have all of these interesting stories that you tell about people. Do you think they discovered principles that we can learn by induction, or are they more like inspiring stories that maybe won't apply? So all of these things, you know?
Oh, this is great questions. You know, I think part of what you and Joanne are doing here is part of the way to keep learning. Mm-hmm. So, for example, when we're sitting here thinking out loud and exchanging our thoughts, we are bringing our own reservoirs of a lot of things we've learned. And so just by listening, you're learning new things. You're like, you're tapping into people who've learned a lot of things and mm-hmm. have insights to share. And it's sort of like they've worked for years to put together their thoughts on things. For example, when you're reading a book, and like when I worked on Mindshift, it's the culmination of, you know, decades of work. Mm-hmm. And so when you read the book Mind Shift, or you read, a book like Cork Dork, that's the one I'm reading right now. I just love this woman. She spent several years learning about the world of wine. And mm-hmm. it's like, I can like learn all this stuff, but actually not have to get hangovers or anything while I'm like she yes. did. And it's just a great way to learn, at least get a sense of things.
Well, I've learned an awful lot about biological topics, and we've had some really great discussions that concern cancer and genetics. And it's a great learning experience talking to people in my computer screen here.
Well, I think the biggest sort of breakthrough is online learning. Mm-hmm. I'm a big proponent of book reading, and I love reading books myself. I think there's actually research that shows that if you read for something like 3.5 hours a week, at least for the those involved mm-hmm. in the study, the book readers, as opposed to the magazine readers and the blog yep. readers and so
we
forth.
We live longer through books.
Precisely.
And I do the diet H200 because I'm straight 3.5 hours a week.
Well, there's something. Do you notice this? When I got really busy. So you get really busy, and then you kind of fall out of that book habit, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so when you intentionally decide that you're going to get back into that book habit, at first, it's really kind of hard to do because you're finding yourself reaching for your cell phone to check yeah. your messages yeah. and stuff. But if you set your cell phone away and kind of get yourself into, you know, like wean yourself onto book reading, you know, you're going to set your cell phone away for 10 minutes, maybe, mm-hmm. or 20 minutes, or a Pomodoro. And then you start reading, you feel this sort of, you know, if you kind of push through the desire to reach for your cell phone, you you begin to fall more into a sort of a comfort with what you're learning about or what you're reading about. And it's almost like parts of your mind relax. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's part of why people who read books live longer.
Maybe. Right. There's certainly pleasurable things involved about it, because a good book is not something that is satisfying just because we learn something new. The best books that we've read for Read Science, and an upcoming episode is a great reason to get back into the habit of reading. The best ones we've read are stimulating to read at the time when you're reading them. Maybe like taking the online course. The thing you said in the book that reminded me, it's like you say that online learning, you were convinced, is very conducive to the way that we actually learn things.
Well-made online learning absolutely is. Yeah. What kind of makes me laugh is that professors will often demean online learning. Mm-hmm. And what they're really demeaning is like the worst, like really bad online learning. And there's a lot of really bad online learning.
Sure.
Because it's so easy to do bad online learning. Yeah. And a lot of the worst stuff is put out to sort of emulate the way we do things in classrooms. And in classrooms, you have students caged. Mm-hmm. So
there's a lot of bad classroom learning, but it's not as visible as an online scenario.
That's right. I mean, it's a statistical truism to say that half of all teachers are below average, right? So when people go, oh, online learning isn't as good as face-to-face, they're somehow in their mind imagining this off-the-charts, terrific face-to-face person, mm-hmm. and this, you know, fairly typical online stuff. Whereas if you get the best of online learning, it is, in general, better than any typical face-to-face teacher. Mm-hmm. And it can be more, you know, more dynamic, more enthusiastic. But I think the big mistake that people are making now is that universities are really used to targeting the 18 to 24-year-old audience. Mm-hmm. But the lifelong learning is a big deal now. People are learning at all ages. So great online providers are targeting the 18 to 80-year-old audience. Mm-hmm. But a lot of universities still don't get that. They think that they can make stuff that works for caged learners in a classroom instead of free-range learners.
No, they don't understand the older. And some of the people that you just were talking about, I think, have a faulty model of what learning is. And they tend to think of learning as something that's done to them rather than something that they do, which is something I just realized is common to all the people that you talked about in your book as examples. They all realize that learning is something that they're in charge of, is something that they do, not something that's done to them.
And it starts right off in Mind Shift with the story of Claudio Meadows and the bus driver, you know, as a bus driver, a very talented, intelligent woman who suffered from severe depression and could never really get herself out of it. And she finally realized that she really needed to actively play a role in her own recovery. Now, is she perfect with her recovery? No, but she's way better than she ever has been. And it's through her learning about what she's doing.
And you think that's maybe that now that I've read it, I see it, maybe that is the best thing I get from the book is these stories that show me the not how to change careers, but the importance of learning, because being a lifelong learner is really a key to lots of opportunity when you're ready for it.
You know, I don't think I've ever like actually synthesized this before your question, but if there is one common strand it is that each of those learners was they began to realize that they had to take active control of mm-hmm. their learning.
Yeah, I think so. Well, good. I hadn't quite seen it until just now either, but yeah, I think that's a lesson that we can learn from all of these fascinating stories about these people and all their differences. That is something that they strongly had in common.
It is funny because when I make when I write a book as opposed to making a MOOC, mm-hmm. I want each one of them to be something that stands alone, so a person can take that MOOC or read that book and they're really happy. They don't feel like, oh man, I should have also been, why didn't I get the book? Or the book, is something that the MOOC builds on or something. Mm-hmm. Each one can feel really comfortable. But there's subconscious stuff that's going on. And now I'm realizing, like one of the very first videos in the MOOC relates to the value of active learning. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I took some video footage that I shot when I was in Taiwan eating stinky tofu and just sort of conveyed the idea that, the experience of actually doing something is irreplaceable, that's one of the most valuable. And it's funny because I don't have anything like that in the book. Mm-hmm. Except I do in that the active learning is sort of a meta idea that's threaded through but not brought forth as obviously as it is in the MOOC.
When I talk to people, I'm almost done, Joanne, maybe for the moment. But, I always talk to Joanne. Just one more. But when I talk to people about writing fiction, which is something that I've done for a while now and stories that I've published, it's one thing that I have, there are not very many experiences where I feel like when people say, oh, I think I can imagine what that would be like. I say writing fiction, but also any kind of writing is really something that is not what you imagine it to be until you do. I think it's worth writing a story for the experience because the experience itself is so much different from what you would imagine it to be.
Yes. Yes. All I can say is my hat is off to fiction writers because it is such an incredibly difficult enterprise. And yet I think it's, one of the greatest, things that people can do in their, I just so admire. I'm so excited because next week I'm going to get to have dinner with Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, he's like such a hero of mine. He's a really wonderful human being.
I know, and this is what you get for creating a MOOC and becoming recognized as someone who has a lot of information about education. You're providing valuable information for a lot of people. I mean, your MOOC is popular because people want to know this stuff. They struggle, like the learning how to learn, right? They struggle. How these people make it look easy, but I'm struggling and I took a test. I thought I knew it, but I didn't know anything, right?
Yes. Although what's really odd is I first met Cormac McCarthy because of writing Evil Genes.
No. Oh.
Isn't that funny?
That's funny. So we're circling you back.
There we go. There we go.
You know, it's funny because some people out there may know I used to be a professional model. Now, I didn't say I want to be a professional model. I was going to medical school. I was not, this was not something. But it was funny because so I did that and I went to college and I went to, and I didn't think much of it until actually I did your book review, right? Because the kids and I had got the camera and I thought, oh, there's all these people online putting stuff online. Oh, what the heck? Let me just do a book review. Because I don't want to have to think about, seven or eight years. And I thought, let me just do this. I'm in my lab. It was a noisy video because the ventilation is very loud in there, but for good reasons. But, and it was funny because after I looked at the tape and I went, oh, I forgot I actually look okay on camera. You know what I mean? Like, you know, yes, people paid me to be on camera, but this was never in the front of my mind that, oh yes, of course I look good on camera. You know what I mean? It wasn't until I looked at this little review I had done for you and went, hey, oh, okay, I could see how this could be useful, right?
Well, to capitalize
on it, you know?
I remember didn't you do something with gummy bears?
Gummy bears, mm-hmm. I did eventually, yes.
It wasn't just that you looked, you know, really good on camera. It was that you were really smart and funny, you know, in doing things, bizarre things with science that, you know, people weren't really thinking about at the time. And so I think you're a talent stack. You have many different skills
that are in, they're in there somewhere. And well, anyway, so how do we get to read science? First of all, I meet Jeff and we ran a little contest for kids and teens for reading science. But the thing is, Google Hangouts came out at a time where I'm tired of editing videos, and you talk about how editing videos is so important for a MOOC, and I do teach online but not MOOCs, but I was tired of editing, tired of trying to figure this out, you know. I'm just like, okay, there's a learning curve and I learned some, but here then I get to you know, Google Hangouts, and I think, oh, I can interview authors of popular science books. Wouldn't that be lovely? And then there's no production. I mean, the biggest production time is trying to get people to say yes, usually they do, and agree on a time. Mm-hmm. But after that, here we are talking, and here, you know, we get to talk to smart people, articulate people, and it goes straight to YouTube. I don't have to post-process it. Mm-hmm. Jeff does a little bit because he turns them into podcasts and things like that, so he helps out. But, you know, it's wonderful because I get to collaborate with Jeff. I get to meet wonderful people. So for me, you know, it was like taking stock of maybe weaknesses, mm-hmm. and, you know, what's worth my time to work on or not work on. And this sort of came as an answer to some of the things I didn't want to continue to improve.
Reading books and talking to authors about it is mostly what we get to do. And, you know, that's a pretty fine thing.
That is a fine thing.
That is an awesome thing. You know, and also having a partner like, you know, you have with Jeff, is it can be so fun. Mm-hmm. My husband Philip and I were at Coursera, for example, yesterday, and we were just critiquing people who are planning to do MOOCs and do videos and so forth. It was so fun, you know. part of the reason it's fun is because you're not on the firing line yourself, right? Mm-hmm. Being videotaped, and so you're just watching somebody else, so you can completely relax because you're not being videotaped. But one thing that really struck me is sometimes you would meet people and they'd seem very you know, just sort of like very, you know, just people, you know, nothing striking about them, you know, that you would think. And then, they might be very shy and so forth. But then they're very resistant to going on camera, and you're thinking, oh man, what am I going to see here? But then when they go on for the camera, oh, it would be like magic. There was so many great aspects. So, Philip and I just had so much fun because sometimes he'd see things that I missed, or we'd see the same things and we'd both kind of reinforce one another, you know, like really good hand gesticulation and, here's my hand there, which I'm not, because I'm holding my computer here. It's on a pillow. So I think it's really fun and creative to work with someone who, you know, in producing creative sorts of things like what you're doing with this Google Hangout.
It's stimulating for me. I can sit and think of things, and I can often be creative, but it nevertheless is all in my own voice. And sometimes, you know, I write things and I write more things and I say, please, somebody needs to write something because it all sounds like me and there's no fertilization going on. It's just, it sounds too much the same to me. So working with someone is a very cross-fertilizing and stimulating sort of
thing. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I know I can tend to get a little bit in my own rut. And sometimes it's frustrating because you're like, it takes so long to explain, you know,
where am I going? Yeah. And now you ran your first Coursera, was in partnership with someone though. This was not just you.
Right. So Philip and I did the course together. And I remember us looking at each other in the basement and going, you know, why are we doing this? I mean, is anybody ever even going to watch this? And, you know, because it was kind of nuts at the time. Very few MOOCs were out. There was like 200 MOOCs on Coursera. You know, my editor is calling me and saying, and I talked a little bit about this in the book Mindshift. My editor is like, we need you to be writing op-eds and we need you to be doing this kind of stuff. And I'm like, no, I'm in the basement making a MOOC. And they're like, what's a MOOC?
You know?
So that was kind of funny. But I do think that it's really fun writing books and making MOOCs because each one is a very different way of conveying information, of teaching, mm-hmm. and they're highly complementary. And I'm like, oh, pinch myself, because how did I get lucky enough to just be at the beginning of the MOOC as a way of conveying information? Because mm-hmm. it's almost like the way I naturally think. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to think with lots of pictures. And it's kind of funny because sometimes I'll just sit there and what I'm thinking is really just sort of a boring piece of information that's important. But then when I go to script it and to envision it, all this funny stuff comes out that kind of brings it to life and makes it. But you can't do it as well in. There's some things you can do better in a book, and there's some things you can do better in a MOOC. And so it's fun contrasting those.
So you know, I'm very well aware of your sense of humor. I mean, even your subtitle, "An Evil Genes," like, which literally got me to buy the book. You know, it is funny. It is a joke. But you talk in Mindshift about how humor mm-hmm. is so important. But then, on the other hand, I also hear, not from Mindshift, but other places, that humor is something you have to be careful with, because not everybody sees humor in the same way. So you must have a certain level of humor that's appreciated by a large number of people. Not an awkward humor, not a off-color humor, not a, you know what I mean? So your reviews are saying, you know, she's great, she's fun, she's this, you know. but humor, I think you have to be careful with. Not everybody gets it, right? And I bet you deal with people from around the world. That's the beauty of a MOOC. They're not just sitting in the USA. They're everywhere. They're India. They're China. Maybe not China, but it depends on how their internet is.
Yeah, because sometimes we're there in China, and sometimes we're not there in China. Mm-hmm. It is. Because humor does not always translate. That's exactly right. But at the same time, what MOOCs can give you is the ability to do visual humor. That visual humor translates pretty well. So if you are, you know, if you tell a witty verbal joke, it may or may not translate. But if you have some kind of, you know, a little bit of wacky visual humor, it odds are it will translate pretty well. So I think that's the lucky thing about that, is that you can do so much more visual humor. I remember my publisher is Penguin Random House, and they are totally awesome. And I mean, I'm just saying that is, sometimes I'll talk to authors and they'll say, you know, you should self-publish. It's really the best way to go. And I'm just like, you have to deal with a, if you deal with a top-notch publisher like Penguin Random House. I feel that they really improve what I do. So, you know, I'll turn my manuscript in and we may argue about stuff, but it turns out better for the fact that they are, that they're partners in it. So for example, when I first began working with them, I was like, I want more pictures. I just want more pictures, you know? And they were like, no, because they're more of a verbal medium. And I realized what I was really trying to do was I was trying to make sort of a written form of MOOC, you know, that has lots of pictures in it. And so finally I acquiesced, and I know at the time they were just thinking, oh man, she's a jerk. You know, what do we do working with her? And ultimately they were right. I was wrong. But I was also kind of right in my own way. People really do like verbal sorts of, visual sorts of things with lots of imagery. I was just trying to do it in the wrong medium.
But you have plenty of pictures, for instance, in Mind for Numbers. Did they stop?
Oh, I wanted more.
Oh, I see. Because I'm like, look at these. We've got lots of pictures. And, you know, your galley of Mind Shift that, you know, I don't know if that's representative of the final, but there's pictures in here of the people you spoke to, some mind map type things.
Oh, yeah. But like, I think I had a limit of 60 and I wanted like 150 pictures.
I see. Yeah. Well, then you reach a point. Is this a coffee table book or a reading book, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And they were totally correct. And I'm so glad that I finally listened to reason. But see, that's where I would have kind of messed up if I'd gone off on my own and tried to create my own self-published book. For one thing, I wouldn't have had the great marketing resources. These are really smart people who have a terrific network. But then for another thing, you know, it just would have been more like a coffee table book.
Exactly.
You know, it wouldn't have been as good. So, I don't know. It's really fun working in these different kinds of creative mediums like book writing versus MOOC making and so forth. And for you, your artistic medium is in some sense Google Hangouts, which is really a creative medium.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I feel I'm so glad. I hope they don't ever take Google Hangouts away.
Well, if they do, we will find we'll find another way to continue doing the fun stuff. Mentoring is on my list of things, is very trendy and has been for the last decade or so. And from some of the things you wrote, I think I agree with you that mentors are not people who are assigned by a lottery or something. It's like, oh, here's your mentor, go ahead. And it was very close, and that sort of circled around one of your people named Zach, I can remember. And the one thing he said, he was talking about apprenticeship, very close. He says it was really about finding positive sum relationships.
Yes.
I really liked that.
I thought, we just had dinner with Zach, let's see, was it last week, I think it was, in New York City. And I thought that was such a perceptive comment of his about, you know, making mentoring be a positive sum sort of thing. And I think mentoring is kind of funny because it has, as you've mentioned, become trendy and over the last decade or so.
Well, there's some interpersonal component too that you can't really assign, I think, that is essential to the trust, the bond, and the way that you get to that sharing of information back and forth that I think is missing from sort of mentoring programs.
Yep. And Zach was making that point too, that he felt that the mentors that he had, let's see, and Arnim Rodick also talked about mm-hmm. mentors, you know, the electrical engineer turned woodworker. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you know, the company would assign mentors sometimes and they just weren't the same as when. But I think a big thing for a while there, I was getting these emails from people saying, just kind of out of the blue, saying, would you be my mentor? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes they'd be rather long emails. And, you know, it's out of the blue, someone I don't know, asking me to be their mentor. And it's like, it's kind of like saying, would you write me a blank check? Mm-hmm. You know, can I take, you know, how much time are you, you know, it's kind of saying, I want you to just write me a commitment that you're going to give me all these hours and you don't even know who I am. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of gave me pause. So when I was exploring the idea of mentoring in the book Mindshift, one thing I wanted to, an important point I think that's sometimes not made is that people can mentor you and they don't even need to know that right. they're a mentor for you. Mm-hmm. And that you have to be very, very careful because, you know, if you don't know that person, you really don't want to walk in and say, hey, please be my mentor, because it's kind of it's sort of like saying, yeah. I mean, it's almost you really.
It seems to me more like an arranged marriage, which might work occasionally, but doesn't seem like the way to go. It's like, hi, Barbara, I'll send you a long email. Would you be my girlfriend?
Yeah. Well, it's not. I mean, like arranged marriages are actually very intelligently done a lot of the time. I mean, mm-hmm. the parents are both looking really carefully at what's going on. Mm-hmm. But a mentorship where somebody just comes up and says, you know, can I be your mentor or would you be my mentor? There's none of that careful sort of thing.
Right. Well, and a lot of people, and I hear this a lot from people who've gained notoriety on Twitter, you know, they happen to be professors, but they've gained some notoriety somehow. And they're suddenly asked to mentor, you know, from lots of people. And that's a lot of time, a commitment for the people who are being asked to be the mentor, right?
Yes.
They have other things to do. And actually, in a way, you could say, well, here's my body of work. And this is how I can mentor you is you continue to engage with this. If you feel my information's valuable, and what's not valuable to you, just set it aside, right?
Right. Well, like today, I got, so I probably get maybe 20, 30 emails a day from people. And, you know, just sort of with questions, advice, and so forth. And sometimes I can answer, and sometimes I just can't. But like this person was writing and saying, you know, can you give me some insight about learning? You know, wow. and you're kind of like, you know, I've written a book about it. I have a big MOOC about it. You know, I don't want to take the time to just stop and try to distill everything I've already put out and you know, much of it free. And so it's kind of funny. But then on the other hand, people do, they reach out to me and do a lot of mentoring for me, even though I don't know them. In other words, they'll write to me, like I have this wonderful, wonderful, somebody who I don't know wrote me several really good references of what's going on in neuroscience related to STEM education.
Oh, awesome.
And I was just like, oh, you know, I started looking at them. And my jaw dropped because they're exactly the kind of information that needs to get out there. And so I'm hoping this person hasn't given up on me because the book came out, the MOOC came out, and so forth. And I haven't had a chance to really read through these things and then get back to them and then say, yes, I'm going to put it in a Cheery Friday email, even though they wrote me like a month ago or something. But it's like, wow. That was mentoring for me, from someone who didn't, and it was, you know, and hopefully I can pass it forward, you know, to you know, so that others can use this incredible information. That's a lucky thing for me, is that people will often reach out and just say, "Have you seen this?" Or and it's super helpful information.
Right. Oh, and you know, while we have you on the topic of Cheery Friday emails, so your outreach goes beyond just your books, beyond your MOOC. You have a Friday email that comes out every Friday, and it's cheery, and you're providing resources to people. I just want to make sure people know about this, that they could go to your website, sign up for this Cheery Friday email, and get this every Friday, except one day on Thursday.
Yes. All they need to do is go to Learning How to Learn on Coursera, and you sign up for the course, and it's free. So if you see these, you know, things that say, you know, buy a certificate, you can buy a certificate, but you can take all the course and everything and get the emails, mm-hmm. and it's all free. So I had no idea. I just started kind of putting together the Cheery Fridays, and now, like, you know, I get off the elevator in Bogota, Colombia, and this woman just stares at me and goes, "Oh, I just got your Cheery Friday email today." You know, I think they're actually my way of continuing learning, because they force me to, you know, I really try to read all the books. Like occasionally, like today's Cheery Friday was something from, you know, that my daughter had suggested. But I do a lot of reading, and it's, you know, so the Cheery Fridays are beneficial for me in many ways, and they, you know, kind of keep me on topic, I think.
Right. And there was, I just wanted to make sure I brought up Joshua Foer's book, Moonwalking with Einstein. That plays a big part in your Mind for Numbers. And I think it comes up in Mind Shift as well. But I remember reading that book and loving that book. And I cannot remember if I did a video review of his book, but I meant to. Joshua? Joshua, if I didn't do it, I'm sorry, but your book was great.
Yes.
Very good book.
It's a really good book. And I hear, you know, sort of behind the scenes through author gossip, that in real life, he truly is just a really, really nice person. And it just always makes me happy when I hear things like that.
Alrighty. So I have one more topic, going back sort of to science.
Yep. Because, and we've got a hard end in 5 minutes, Jeff.
Because, I'm sure we can do this in just 90 seconds.
Okay.
But anyway, you wrote that we should avoid fooling ourselves, and I forget the context, but I remember thinking, boy, do you sound like Richard Feynman, who thought that the best way science, and you know, he's willing to say science may not be the only truth ever, but it's the best way we have of not fooling ourselves. And at the time, you were talking about Joan McCord's research on the ineffectiveness of what some people describe as obviously useful social programs. So how to avoid fooling ourselves is a tricky one, isn't it?
It really is, because we often surround ourselves with people who believe the same way we do and think mm-hmm. the same we do. And we don't like to hang out with people who are going to criticize our ideas, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to just think, man, whatever I'm doing is super helpful for other people. I know it. I feel it inside. In fact, I remember talking with this researcher, and she was going, "Oh, you know, all the statistics, that's just sort of hand waving to convince people that we've actually really studied. But you and I already know that this is a good program." And I'm just like, no, we don't.
Yeah.
Please don't do this, you know, but it's actually done way more than we think, you know, and mm-hmm. the thing is, if you really want to help other people, and I do, the first thing you have to realize is that sometimes it's your helpful efforts that are, you know, that make things worse. But you try to tell people that sometimes, and they're like, but my thing is truly helping. I know it. I can feel it. And it's a really, really tough road.
So I'll finish the last piece of advice I wanted to quote, because I was so amused by it. and it seems so wise. Early on in the book, you told us to collect shiny objects.
That was Claudia. She was great. I love what she did with that. Collects shiny objects. And I still do that. I get, you know, it's the essential idea is around you, you know, try to have things that make you feel better, that keep you upbeat. Because there's already enough downbeat stuff going on around you all the time. And it's almost like the dirty stuff that just gets on you of a day. That's the reason that we take showers or take baths. And you need to always be taking showers and baths. You know, I mean, at least, you know, at least every once in a while.
You do, because motivation is like bathing. It wears off. It doesn't last.
That's right. That's right. That was also in the book. We're down to 2 minutes. Before I give Barbara the last word, I do just want to say, if you have not picked up Mind Shift, quick read, inspirational stories. There's a message in all of them. And of course, her Mind for Numbers. It's done really well for you. So this one's very good. And they're a great pair. Peanut butter and jelly, you should put them together if you want things, right? And so Barbara, is there anything else you would like to add before you have to go take your next phone call?
Yes, I would like to add for you, if you're watching this show, keep on watching Joanne and Jeff because they're incredible.
That is wonderful. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. Well,
and it's so good to reconnect with you, Barbara. I know it's been a few years.
Yes. Yep. But you're doing great work. And I think just by us watching, we learn a lot.
Yeah. Well, we hope, that's what we hope, give a chance for authors to share in a bit of a, you know, more expanded format, what they are doing.
A lot of fascinating stories.
Very fascinating stories. Beats, you know, even though NPR is great, they get, 7 minutes? So here you get a chance to talk for an hour.
And it's the stuff I don't usually get to talk about.
Yeah. Exactly. All the interviews end up being the same. That's what authors tell us all the time. Oh, I never get to talk about this. Thank you for letting me talk about it. So, Barbara, first of all, thank you so much for joining us. Really glad to have you on. Congratulations with all your amazing success with your books and your MOOCs. And I won't be such a stranger now.
It's a deal. Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. And until next time.
Thank you, everybody, for watching. Thank you, Jeff, as always.
Thank you, Joanne.
We'll see you soon on Read Science. We got a lot lined up this month.